Every day, children fall victims to abuse, violence, and exploitation, experiencing physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. Some find themselves at the mercy of human traffickers who enslave them into a world of prostitution, domestic servitude, and bonded labor. On Breakout with BD on the BBS radio station 1, hosted by Demi Nelson, illuminates the clandestine world of child abuse and human trafficking, breaking the silence and becoming a voice to the millions of voiceless children in the world today.
Hello everyone. You're welcome to another edition of Breakout with BD. My name is Demi Nelson. I apologize for my inability to bring this show to you for the past 3 weeks now. This was as a result of some horrible hiccups I experienced at my end. So, going forward, you will be listening to my pre-recorded shows pending the time those challenges I mentioned will be totally taken care of. On today's show, though, we have a couple of interesting things lined up for your listening pleasure. But more importantly, this show is to inspire you to be a part of that needed change in ending child abuse in your society and neighborhood. The world can be abuse and violence free for children. Together, we can make this happen. Our major discourse for today is going to be centered on children in poverty. Thereafter, we will move on to our second segment, which is tagged On the Job Again. Here, we will be talking about managing stress in the workplace. Our third segment, News on Breakout, will be serving you the latest gist on issues pertaining to children across the globe. And I will not forget the celebration of people I call Angels on the Mission, who are positive and proactive in checking and stopping the menace of abuse and violence, especially towards children. And that means we will be ending the show with that last segment tagged Angels on a Mission. Now, before I introduce my guests for today, I'd like us to have an overview of what poverty really is. When many of us hear the word poverty, we think it's very relative to certain parts of the world. When I was younger, I used to think poverty was custom made for Africa. So when I hear the word poverty, I think of starved, emaciated, and wasted Africans. I also think of a problem that just can't be solved. However, as I became more advanced in age, I saw that poverty was not only in Africa, but everywhere in the world. It's even in some of the most advanced countries, like the United States, for instance. Now, here are some very interesting information. First, in developed countries, studies have shown a strong association between the level of a family's poverty and the health and social outcomes of their children. There is strong proof to suggest that children of low-income parents have an increased risk of intellectual and behavioral developmental problems. Other studies suggest other factors like the parents' mental skill, the parents' education, and the parents' psychological state. Now, these three things are very important and may increase the risk of a child having developmental problems. Besides, there are some suggestions that prove poverty might cause a child to develop or to have developmental problems because of problems or factors that relate to that child having a substandard diet, inferior housing conditions, poor neighborhood environment, reduced access to goods and services, as well as the psychological stress that arise from the things I've mentioned earlier. So when you have the combination of diet, a substandard diet, not too good housing conditions, probably a violent neighborhood, and maybe reduced ability or reduced bargaining power or reduced income to buy goods and other things, this could actually build into some form of psychological stress. Now let's look at the data on poverty in the United States. Nearly 15 million American children live in poverty, and that is a hard fact. The effects of poverty take the lives of 27 children in the United States every day. Families with children make up about 40% of the people who become homeless, and children account for 25% of the homeless population. 50% of people who become poor each year are children. And since 1975, the child poverty rate has increased by over 40%. 12 million American children may have no health insurance, and millions of others have inadequate insurance. Now let's look at the data in developing nations or in the developing countries around the world. According to a UN report published in 1995, an impoverished child growing up in a developing country would suffer more hardship than most children living in poverty in a developed country. Poverty in this country is a condition usually characterized by severe deprivation of basic human needs. It is estimated that 1/3 of all children in developing countries are living in poverty, and the highest rates being in the rural areas of sub-Saharan Africa and for places like South Asia, where we have over 70% of the children there living in poverty. Now, some other things that might lead to poverty includes war, diseases, corruption, lack of resources, or better put, inequitable distribution of resources, and harsh environmental conditions. Now, this is true if you look at the recent happenings in the Horn of Africa. I'm talking about what is happening currently in Somalia, in Uganda, in Kenya, in Djibouti, in Ethiopia. You find out that those countries are currently going through the worst drought since their history, and many children have lost their lives as a result of hunger and malnutrition and diseases and so many unfavorable, unpleasant and unstable conditions of that country. We know that this is a source of concern for many people today. So we all can't just look the other way and say, you know, it's none of our business. I think that's not the right thing to do. that being said, it's important for us to know that nearly half the world's 6 billion people live on less than $2 a day. In developed countries, it is estimated that 1 in 10 children live below the poverty line. The situation in developing countries is even much worse. Now, I'd like us to have and also know the major indicators of poverty. And what I mean by that is, when you say someone is impoverished, what are we talking about? Now, we know that a person is in the state of poverty when he is deprived of food, when he lacks access to safe drinking water, when he lacks access to sanitation, when there is absence of shelter or a proper form of housing, when that person lacks access to health care services, when that person lacks education and other sources of information, most likely because they can't afford to get them. When that person lives because of the high living costs, then the person now begins to live at a very distant or at a low cost area, which is far from his workplace. Now he incurs a very huge amount in terms of transporting himself to work, and this is usually found among very poor people. They usually have high cost of transportation as one of the avenues through which they do their, you know, through which money leaves their pocket. And also they have issues with, you know, increased cost of childcare. I know this is a problem in Texas for many poor people in Texas. And then many of them, their wages are usually not enough to take care of them and the family. And joining me today to talk about this topic, children in poverty, is actually a family that is in poverty. And this is a Nigerian family, and specifically it's a mother and her daughter who have been living in very tough and rough conditions since day one of their lives. Rebecca and Blessing, and these are not their real names, will be sharing their experiences on this matter. And I really hope we will all get to see what it's like to live in abject poverty from the very beginning of one's life. I had the opportunity to meet this family through a man called Martin Mary. He's the founder of the Kids and Teens Resource Center in southern Nigeria. This is a non-profit organization with focus on securing the future of young people towards poverty eradication, education, good health, and the enforcement of child rights. I must warn you that you may have to listen closely and attentively so you can grasp what Rebecca and Blessing are trying to communicate.
Thank you.
Rebecca, you're welcome to the show.
Thank you, Ma.
And Blessing, you're also welcome.
Thank you, Ma.
Now, Rebecca, let me start with you. When people hear about poverty, they believe it's usually self-inflicted. And by that, I mean they believe you are the reason for your own poverty. You are the cause of your poor state. Now, I want you to start by telling me a little bit about yourself. How did you find yourself in an impoverished state?
Thank you, Ma. The medley that born me, I was 3 months child when my mother died. And my father have a three wife, and some I take group my bit myself. They won't take care of me to go school, to do other things, that's no more. That's why I just get myself like that.
Now, for people who are wondering why Rebecca is speaking like that, it's because Rebecca did not have the opportunity to go to school like many of us did. And she still made an effort to learn how to communicate. And I really want to applaud her for that. And what she's trying to make us understand here is she was she lost her mother. She became motherless at the age of 3 months when she was still a baby. And the father who was supposed to be the only parent figure that she knew totally neglected her. And for obvious reasons too, the father was a polygamist and he had about 3 wives, and these women and the father also did not take it upon themselves to raise Rebecca the way she should be raised. So that's just about Rebecca's background and her upbringing. Now, Rebecca, how did you meet your husband? And when you met him, was he also a poor man? You know, and why would you marry a poor man?
The place where I live in, that place is a farm. You know, so anybody who is there for farm, anybody who says she likes this your girl, they will just give to her. That is why I meet my husband from the place of the farm, for Ajawa Koko State. That from there I will get my husband. And he said, come from the poor family too.
Now, she's saying that in the neighborhood where she grew up, in those days when they see a damsel or a young lady who has reached a marriageable age, all they need to show was interest, and that is enough to consolidate a marriage institution. So she met her husband, who also was not so well-to-do, but he loved her, and I'm sure they believed they could make something work, and then they got married. And I had a chat with Rebecca before this show, and she told me she has 5 kids, a daughter and 4 sons, and Blessing is the only daughter that she has. And Blessing is also going to tell us a little bit about herself. So Blessing, tell us something about your childhood and what you are currently going through now.
I was born into poverty, and my parents were not able to reach to take good care of me, but they are only trying their best.
So, all your life you never had an education, you never really had the best of life?
Yes, I not really have the best of life, but we thank God. God is even doing the best for us. I started school at the age of 8 years, which was supposed not to be so.
You started schooling at the age of 8?
Yes.
And that means you started nursery school when you were 8 years, or you started primary school when you were 8 years?
I started primary one when I was 8 years.
And for my listeners to understand, in the Nigerian context, in this context, usually a child is supposed to start his or her primary education when they are probably 6 or 5 years old. That's what is generally acceptable. So we have a girl whose education was delayed by as long as 2 years just because they did not have the necessary resources to survive or to send her to school. What was feeding like? You know, how tough was feeding in your home for you and your brothers. Was there any time you people went home went to bed hungry, without anything to eat? You know, how tough was it for you?
It was so tough for us to get food. Sometimes we eat once daily.
You eat once?
Yes.
And how old were you when you ate once daily?
It's my childhood up to now.
Up to now, you still eat once daily?
Yeah. Yes.
My goodness, I don't know what to say, but I keep saying this. We can't just behave like these things are not our concerns. This is a young girl whose childhood, as a child growing up and you know, moving through her childhood, she only could eat once a day. And I'm wondering how many of us can go through life by eating once a day. It's tough for people living in poverty. You need to see them, you need to meet with them, you need to hear their stories to really understand the situation that they are in. Now, Blessing, you are how old? How old are you now?
I am 17 years old.
And what class are you in now?
ISS 1.
Now, you told me that you were not able to continue your education until you met somebody, and that was a man called Martin Mary, who runs this organization called the Kids and Teens Concern. How did you meet this man?
I was coming back from school hungrily one afternoon. So when we met, so he asked my name. I told him and he asked about my family. I explained everything about him, and he volunteered to help. And he said I should be coming to his office every time.
So you were walking home and you met him by the roadside?
Yes, ma'am.
And he offered to help your family. And has he kept to his promise?
Yes, he's trying.
You told me he pays your school fees. Is that true?
Yes, ma'am.
And also the fees of your younger ones?
Yes, he did everything.
Now, what did you do, or what have you been doing to support your mother in helping you people survive? How have you been able to support your mother to make ends meet? What do you do after coming back from school or before going to school? What are those things you do to support your mother's work and income?
I do hawk for her anything she's selling. I do hawk in the afternoon until evening before going back to school, before going home. And when during weekend, I do go to people's homes to wash their clothes, wash their places and their bedroom for them.
Now, this is a 17-year-old girl who is in SS1, and that means she just completed her junior secondary school education. And ordinarily, in a normal classroom context, she probably would be the oldest person in the class, because the age range of people in junior secondary school, you usually find them between the ages of maybe 9 and 13. But she's 17 and she's just going into SS1, which is the senior secondary class, the first class in the senior secondary school. Now, we can see here that poverty has the effects of poverty are multifaceted. It affects the feeding of a child, the nutrition of a child. It affects the education of a child. It affects even the getting a roof over their heads. Where do you stay, Rebecca? How do you pay for your house rent? Your rent. How do you do that?
One of the completely building that woman I used to help me. There's no door, no window, nothing. Just to manage it like that.
So you live in an uncompleted building without a door or windows? No ceilings too?
No ceiling, nothing.
Now, my goodness, I just cannot believe this, but I don't know what to say. But this is the reality of the situation facing so many families in Africa and also in Nigeria. They don't have money to rent a conducive flat, a conducive apartment to live in. So they have to manage in an uncompleted building without ceiling, without roof, without a door, you know, and they are all there exposed to the elements of the weather. When the rain comes, it comes right on them. When it's sunny, it comes right on them. When you have, you know, dangerous animals around, they are not protected. So how then can we just sit back and say, this is not our concern? This behavior definitely has to stop. It's just not right. We need to support organizations that is reaching out to people like this to make their lives better, because at the end of the day, we are trying to make our own lives better too. Okay, Rebecca, now, what do you do to earn money? What do you do to survive? What kind of work do you do?
I can play chess, and if I see money, I can do any business I like.
Now, Rebecca told me before the show that she makes hair, and that means she's a hairdresser. And also, she's into subsistence farming. She's a small-scale farmer and trader as well, who would really love to go back to the farm and go and get, you know, get foodstuff back from the farm and go into the market and sell it so that she can earn some little money and take care of her children. And she told me that Martin Mary, who is one of the support sources that she has, you know, he can't meet all the family needs. And she wants to do something to change her situation. And she's asking every one of us to do something about it. Let's see how we can reach out to organizations like the Kids and Teens Concern. These people know how to get across to them. Now, on a final note, Rebecca, what exactly, what message would you like to pass across to parents to ensure that their children don't continue in this cycle of poverty? You know, what do you think parents can do?
The parents have the money we can use to train the children. The children, they cannot cross the poverty. Is the money the problem?
She is saying that parents need money to raise their children. And I remember in one of the last shows I did, where I actually invited Martin Mary to that show, he said that it's becoming a criminal offense for parents to have kids that they cannot cater for. So please, if you know that you don't have the means to take care of your children, plan your family. You know, just don't have so many children that at the end of the day they would suffer. You need to learn how to plan your family so that the little you have will be enough for them. Now, Blessing, what do you have, anything you like to tell my listeners, you know, maybe in the form of an advice or a solicitation for help and assistance?
I would like to advise the parents to just cater for their children, even though if they don't have enough to cater, advice is only enough for the children to use.
You are telling me that your mother is not harsh, that she was very supportive of you. She told you not to maybe go into things like prostitution or sell your body for money. She kept on encouraging you to do the right things, right?
Yes, that is why I call her a caring mother.
So you want parents to be also caring, irrespective of their situation, whether they are poor or in an unfavorable condition. They need to be supportive of their children, right?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. And I really want to thank Rebecca and Blessing for coming on today's show. It might not be the usual show that you know that I'm used to doing, but I like to hit the nail on the head. I like to get to the crux of the matter. And I'm actually sitting together with people who are facing trying times. For more information about the NGO, the non-governmental organization that is assisting them, you'll find that on my profile page. The name of the organization is Kids and Teens Concern and is managed by a gentleman known as Martin Mary. I'll be right back. My God, I have never had this much reality thrust right back at me. Summarily, Rebecca and Blessing have tried to express and share some of the things that they have gone through in their family with us. And Rebecca made us understand that her being in an impoverished state was not something she chose for herself, but it started when she lost her mother at the tender age of 3 months, and then following a cruel behavior by the father who totally neglected her, and obviously because he was a polygamist. And then she went ahead to get married, and the cycle continued because she married somebody who was also from a very poor background. Usually, poor people try to escape poverty, and many of the women in very poor households would try and escape poverty by getting married to someone rich and maybe someone who doesn't even reside in their country. And at the end of the day, they might end up being victims of human traffickers. But for those that don't fall into this category, the cycle of poverty will usually continue. She said that she would like to take better care of her family because the man who was responsible for my meeting them, the man known as Martin Mary, could not take care of all the needs of the family. And this is a family with 5 children. And so she needs to go back to the farm and begin to practice some small scale farming and then sell the produce of the farm in the market so she can earn some little money to take care of her family and feed them at least. And I looked at her daughter Blessing, I looked into her eyes and I just saw this very distant and blank stare. Although she sounded optimistic and she kept telling me about her mother's support and advice, you know, to her not to make wrong decisions and all of that, but I wonder how long that optimism is going to carry this young girl. You know, I wonder how far it would carry her. She talked about her delayed education and obviously because they had no money to pay. And then many children from poor households would rather work than go to school so that they can earn something to take care of their needs. And she said that she did a lot of work, you know, as even up till this moment. She still goes to hotels to wash clothes. She hawks on the street. She sells things on the street. And all of this are not healthy for the proper development of a child. But what choice does this little girl have? You know, it's a very sad story. And Rebecca was telling me tearfully that she lost her husband to a respiratory condition known as asthma, just because they had no money to take this man to the hospital and get the right medical attention and the right drugs that could take care of him. And that man was the breadwinner of that family. And when he died, things became much worse for them. I'd like us to consider quickly the consequences of poverty on children. And it's important that we know that many children who are raised in poverty would usually remain in poverty as adults. In fact, boys raised in poverty are twice as likely to be arrested and three times as likely to be incarcerated. Girls raised in poverty are five times as likely to bear a child out of wedlock prior to the age of 21. These children, when they become adults, they complete two fewer years of schooling, and as such, they earn half as much as children who complete their years of schooling and children who are raised in non-poor households. As adults, they are more than twice as likely to report poor overall health and high levels of psychological distress. And why would that not happen? You tell me. Additionally, we should know, for those of us who don't, that many poor children actually didn't start off being poor. They fell into poverty during the recession that hit the world's economy some time ago. And these children are at a risk of earning lower overall incomes, achieving lower levels of education, reporting poorer health, and will have a greater chance of falling back into poverty later in their lives. This is a sad truth, but if we leave children to remain in poverty, that is what would befall them. I'd like us to think deeply about this word, poverty alleviation. Poverty alleviation. Many world leaders, especially in Africa, seem to include it often in their vocabulary when they want to assume power, but they don't have the faintest idea of what it really is. Many of the programs that they prefer can hardly better the situation of their citizenry, not to talk of building their lives, not to talk of the citizenry now, building their lives on this program. There has been no substantive improvement in the fight against poverty in many countries today. If you need proof, check out Africa. Taking a cue from the Western world, we've been able to see that they have been able to reduce poverty because of certain incentives and initiatives which they began to effect for their citizens. Some of them includes the provision of jobs, the provision of welfare programs and some form of leverage, affordable health care and counseling, investment in public schools, building affordable houses, looking for for viable ways out of social problems like teenage pregnancy, taking care of the issue of security and all of that. But if you look at some other countries in the world where poverty has been entrenched, it's quite different. There's a lot of talk about ending poverty, alleviating poverty, but no tangible result is yet to be seen. I would advise governments of all these countries who are still battling with poverty to take a cue from the Western world and see how they have been able to combat this menace and try and imitate what they have done as much as they can. But moving on from the role of the government in combating poverty, let's see our role as individuals. A man known as Carlos Slim, and he is one of the richest men in the world, he once said, and I quote, "Poverty isn't solved with donations." Maybe he's right, and he may be right if and only if poverty has become the personality of the mind and maybe the mentality of the poor. Nonetheless, we have seen poverty can only be eradicated by giving something that is lacked or something that is needed by poor people. Sometimes this something, these poor people don't even know that they lack it, and most of the time is a change in their mindset. And even when we know that our giving or our donations are not enough, I think it's time for us to reflect and then move ahead to improve on the quality of our gifts to people in poverty. It's one thing to give, and it's one thing to give what is really needed. Why don't you give your time? Why don't you spend a little time with these people to know them? How about mentoring them or teaching them some of the fundamentals of wealth, such as creativity, developing a savings habit, having some form of accountability, responsibility towards self and family, more especially towards the children in one's family, and imbibing some form of positivity in their approach towards life and the society. And I believe the women folk will need this the most. You know, if you touch a woman's life, you touch the lives of her children, you touch the lives of the people in her family. And I tell you, you'll be amazed at how families and economies will become more productive, stronger, and more stable. I'll be right back after this break. You're welcome back from that break. On our second segment, which I tag On the Job Again, we will be looking at a topic, managing stress in the workplace. And according to a report by Carrie I. Cooper and Susan Cartwright in the book Business, the Ultimate Resource, they did a wonderful work on defining the sources and symptoms and solutions to stress in the workplace. As you all know, this segment is basically to help and encourage you to be the best that you can be on your job and also in your home. I believe if you have things going well for you on the job, or better put, if you are able to manage your job situation well, achieve your goals and objectives, meet your targets, you have a better chance of being a better parent and a better caregiver. And that is the essence of this segment. Let's start today's discussion by looking at the prevalence of stress. According to Carrie and Susan, they said stress has become a thing of prestige for many occupations. It's not new when you hear someone who just had a job remark that his job is very stressful. And he's not trying to send a wrong notion, but he's trying to make you believe that without the stress in the job, there's basically no job. And it's funny how stress has suddenly become a part of the jobs and lives of many people, and the tendency for people to want to embrace it and make it a permanent guest in their work lives. Now, we'll look at the origin of stress. And according to that report, it said, stress originates from pressure. And pressure is supposed to be motivating, stimulating, and energizing. But when it exceeds an individual's ability to cope, it becomes stress. Here are some of the symptoms, the physical symptoms of stress. Now, if you are going through stress at work, you might have issues with lack of appetite or craving for food under pressure. And little wonder many employees would gain and lose weight so easily when they are under a lot of pressure at work. Another symptom is frequent indigestion or heartburn. You could also have constipation or diarrhea, insomnia, the tendency to sweat for no reason. Usually you find them with sweaty hands, their armpits all sweaty, sometimes itchy, you know, for no reason. You might also have headaches, nervous twitches, nail biting, cramps, and muscle spasms. You might have nausea, breathlessness without exertion, fainting spells, impotency or frigidity, and even eczema. Now, these are certainly not desirable symptoms anybody would want to have. But let's move from the physical symptoms and see what happens on the inside. The emotional and behavioral symptoms that come with stress would include constant irritability with people, difficulty in making decisions, loss of sense of humor, suppressed or expressed anger, difficulty concentrating, inability to finish one task before rushing to another, feeling targeted by other people's animosity, feeling unable to cope, wanting to cry at the smallest problem, lack of interest in doing fun things after returning home from work, and I certainly don't like that. Waking up in the morning and feeling tired after an early night, constant tiredness. Now, those are some of the emotional or behavioral symptoms of stress. Now, they moved on to talk about the sources of workplace stress, and they mentioned things like a bullying boss. When you have to deal with a boss who is a bully, could be a source of stress for an employee. Also, coping with a dysfunctional corporate management, procrastination, and these people who procrastinate would rather think about work instead of doing it. You also have issues with poor delegation of duty or work. So people who have this, who are overburdened with work, because they are doing work that could have been done by someone else, work that is expected to be done by someone else. We also have things like disorganization, and guys who are usually disorganized will miss an appointment or go late for it. They think they are stressed up as a result of work overload instead of their disorganization. We also have things like confusion when an employee or staff does not know the purpose or objective of his work. This often causes inner speculation and questioning on what they should do rather than do it. And this is certainly a time waster and it also overburdens your mind, it overburdens your brain. Now let's look at things like interruptions through the telephone, emails dropped by co-workers, and so on. Now let's see how the telephone interrupts an employee at work. And when an employee does not place time limits on his telephone calls, when he does not use his voicemail, especially when he needs to perform a complex task, when he does not prioritize his emails and would rather respond to the emails in the order of arrival instead of responding to those emails in the order of importance, and much more often than not, when these employees have their cell phones on all the time. Let's see how drop by co-workers can bring about interruptions in the workplace. When your door is always opened, when you don't put a notice outside your door to establish quiet working hours of interrupted work for you, when you don't have visiting hours, when you can't control conversation by talkative persons, and I mean you have to do this politely by asking them to make their main points, and when you are unexpectedly interrupted, when you don't know how to manage the person who unexpectedly interrupts you, this would always be a source of stress for an employee. Now, the recession has brought a lot of bad memories, and among such is the lack of job security, and this has also brought stress in the workplace. And if you look at the organizations we have, many organizations have gone through a period or a process of rebirth, and with the rebirth comes new expectations. The new organizations of today have a new psyche. They are more flexible, they are more accountable, and they want their employees to be more flexible as well. They want their employees to be more accountable, more hardworking, more committed to work, and they don't want to promise any assurance of job security or any prospect of career development. So imagine the burden of stress on an employee who has to suddenly adopt a new psyche, a new work psyche, who has to suddenly become more flexible, accommodate extra work, accommodate extra hours without complaining, who has to suddenly become more accountable, who must increase his work, increase his commitment, and he's getting nothing in return, not even the promise of job security or a promise of career development, which would impact his productivity. These things would always bring headache to an employee. Now, what is the way forward? They say, as an employee, you must learn to understand yourself. You must look inward. What causes your stress? When are you likely to be stressed? How can you avoid these situations? Think about past stressful occurrences. How did you react to them? The consequences of your reaction and behavior. And do you think you handled it the best possible way? They also advised that employees begin to take responsibility for actions and occurrences at the workplace. Stop blaming others for the problems around you, even though it might be their fault. Once you as an employee is affected by the problem, you have a responsibility and duty to resolve it. You must look outward as well. Where is stress coming from? Is it coming from work? Your work role? Your work relationship? Is it coming from an organizational change? Or probably, is it work related at all? Once the source of stress has been identified, addressing it one step at a time is the next thing to do. That is the only way to effectively take care of this problem. Now, as employees, you must anticipate stress both at home and work and plan for it. You may solicit professional help if the need arises. You need to put some management techniques to use, things like time management, assertiveness, especially when you are saying yes or no. You need to also put things like controlled behavior into play, effective communication, and this helps you a lot when you are delegating duties. You also have to learn to make effective decisions. You have to learn problem-solving skills. You have to learn about all of these things and use them to your advantage at work. And the last thing is, you must learn to relax. And I know a lot of you out there are saying that is totally not possible. But I believe if you practice, you can become perfect. Go for holidays. Find a relaxing hobby or club and absorb yourself into it. Think about a spa, how you just go into it, your whole body, sometimes your mind. That's the way you should soak yourself into a relaxing hobby or a club. Take time away from stress and take time away from stressful situations. And when you do this, you have a higher tendency to put things at work in the right perspective. Now, what is your role as an employee in reducing stress in your workplace and also reducing stress for others? You must acknowledge stress in other people and you must learn to support them. This can empower stressed colleagues to remove stress and ultimately overcome the problem. So if this stress is coming from another guy, if you don't help and reach out to him, that stress may be transferred to you. You also must learn to build a positive team and work environment. Develop good communication. Be blame-free in the way you talk to people, in your responses, in your approach, in your attitude to other people. Let's create a blame-free work environment and let's have a higher sense of responsibility both to our work and to our colleagues. Let me end this by quoting John Ruskin in 1851, and he said, "In order that people may be happy in their work, these three things are needed. They must be fit for it, they must not do too much of it, and they must have a sense of success in it." If you need more information about this article written by these two wonderful business managers, you could contact me for more information. My contact is on my profile page. I will be right back after this break. You're welcome back from that break. On our second segment, which I tag On the Job Again, we will be looking at a topic, managing stress in the workplace. And according to a report by Carrie I. Cooper and Susan Cartwright in the book Business, the Ultimate Resource, they did a wonderful work on defining the sources and symptoms and solutions to stress in the workplace. As you all know, this segment is basically to help and encourage you to be the best that you can be on your job and also in your home. I believe if you have things going well for you on the job, or better put, if you are able to manage your job situation well, achieve your goals and objective, meet your targets, you have a better chance of being a better parent and a better caregiver. And that is the essence of this segment. Let's start today's discussion by looking at the prevalence of stress. According to Carrie and Susan, they said stress has become a thing of prestige for many occupations. It's not new when you hear someone who just had a job remark that his job is very stressful. And he's not trying to send a wrong notion, but he's trying to make you believe that without the stress in the job, there's basically no job. And it's funny how stress has suddenly become a part of the jobs and lives of many people, and the tendency for people to want to embrace it and make it a permanent guest in their work lives. Now, we'll look at the origin of stress. And according to that report, it said stress originates from pressure. And pressure is supposed to be motivating, stimulating, and energizing. But when it exceeds an individual's ability to cope, it becomes stress. Here are some of the symptoms, the physical symptoms of stress. Now, if you are going through stress at work, you might have issues with lack of appetite or craving for food under pressure. And little wonder many employees would gain and lose weight so easily when they are under a lot of pressure at work. Another symptom is frequent indigestion or heartburn. You could also have constipation or diarrhea, insomnia, the tendency to sweat for no reason. Usually you find them with sweaty hands, their armpits all sweaty, sometimes itchy, you know, for no reason. You might also have headaches, nervous twitches, nail biting, cramps, and muscle spasms. You might have nausea, breathlessness without exertion, fainting spells, impotency or frigidity, and even eczema. Now, these are certainly not desirable symptoms anybody would want to have. But let's move from the physical symptoms and see what happens on the inside. The emotional and behavioral symptoms that come with stress would include constant irritability with people, difficulty in making decisions, loss of sense of humor, suppressed or expressed anger, difficulty concentrating, inability to finish one task before rushing to another, feeling targeted by other people's animosity, feeling unable to cope, wanting to cry at the smallest problem, lack of interest in doing fun things after returning home from work, and I certainly don't like that. Waking up in the morning and feeling tired after an early night, constant tiredness. Now, those are some of the emotional or behavioral symptoms of stress. Now, they moved on to talk about the sources of workplace stress, and they mentioned things like a bullying boss. When you have to deal with a boss who is a bully, could be a source of stress for an employee. Also, coping with a dysfunctional corporate management, procrastination, and these people who procrastinate would rather think about work instead of doing it. You also have issues with poor delegation of duty or work. So people who have this, who are overburdened with work, because they are doing work that could have been done by someone else, work that is expected to be done by someone else. We also have things like disorganization, and guys who are usually disorganized will miss an appointment or go late for it. They think they are stressed up as a result of work overload instead of their disorganization. We also have things like confusion when an employee or staff does not know the purpose or objective of his work. This often causes inner speculation and questioning on what they should do rather than do it. And this is certainly a time waster, and it also overburdens your mind. It overburdens your brain. Now let's look at things like interruption. Interruptions through the telephone, emails, dropped by co-workers, and so on. Now let's see how the telephone interrupts an employee at work. And when an employee does not place time limits on his telephone calls, when he does not use his voicemail, especially when he needs to perform a complex task, when he does not prioritize his emails and would rather respond to the emails in the order of arrival instead of responding to those emails in the order of importance. And much more often than not, when these employees have their cell phones on all the time. Let's see how drop-by co-workers can bring about interruptions in the workplace. When your door is always opened, when you don't put a notice outside your door to establish quiet working hours of interrupted work for you, when you don't have visiting hours, when you can't control conversation by talkative persons, and I mean you have to do this politely by asking them to make their main points, and when you are unexpectedly interrupted, when you don't know how to manage the person who unexpectedly interrupts you, this would always be a source of stress for an employee. Now, the recession has brought a lot of bad memories, and among such is the lack of job security, and this has also brought stress in the workplace. And if you look at the organizations we have, many organizations have gone through a period or process of rebirth, and with the rebirth comes new expectations. The new organizations of today have a new psyche. They are more flexible. They are more accountable. And they want their employees to be more flexible as well. They want their employees to be more accountable, more hardworking, more committed to work, and they don't want to promise any assurance of job security or any prospect of career development. So imagine the burden of stress on an employee who has to suddenly adopt a new psyche, a new work psyche, who has to suddenly become more flexible, accommodate extra work, accommodate extra hours without complaining, who has to suddenly become more accountable, who must increase his work, increase his commitment, and he's getting nothing in return, not even the promise of job security or a promise of career development, which would impact his productivity. These things would always bring headache to an employee. Now, what is the way forward? They say, as an employee, you must learn to understand yourself. You must look inward. What causes your stress? When are you likely to be stressed? How can you avoid these situations? Think about past stressful occurrences. How did you react to them? The consequences of your reaction and behavior. And do you think you handled it the best possible way? They also advised that employees begin to take responsibility for actions and occurrences at the workplace. Stop blaming others for the problems around you, even though it might be their fault. Once you, as an employee, is affected by the problem, you have a responsibility and duty to resolve it. You must look outward as well. Where is stress coming from? Is it coming from work, your work role, your work relationship? Is it coming from an organizational change? Or probably, is it work related at all? Once the source of stress has been identified, addressing it one step at a time is the next thing to do. That is the only way to effectively take care of this problem. Now, as employees, you must anticipate stress both at home and work and plan for it. You may solicit professional help if the need arises. You need to put some management techniques to use. Things like time management, assertiveness, especially when you are saying yes or no. You need to also put things like controlled behavior into play, effective communication, and this helps you a lot when you are delegating duties. You also have to learn to make effective decisions. You have to learn problem-solving skills. You have to learn about all of these things and use them to your advantage at work. And the last thing is, you must learn to relax. And I know a lot of you out there are saying that is totally not possible. But I believe if you practice, you can become perfect. Go for holidays. Find a relaxing hobby or club and absorb yourself into it. Think about a spa, how you just go into it, your whole body, sometimes your mind. That's the way you should soak yourself into a relaxing hobby or a club. Take time away from stress and take time away from stressful situations. And when you do this, you have a higher tendency to put things at work in the right perspective. Now, what is your role as an employee in reducing stress in your workplace and also reducing stress for others? You must acknowledge stress in other people and you must learn to support them. This can empower stressed colleagues to remove stress and ultimately overcome the problem. So if this stress is coming from another guy, if you don't help and reach out to him, that stress may be transferred to you. You also must learn to build a positive team and work environment. Develop good communication. Be blame-free in the way you talk to people, in your responses, in your approach, in your attitude to other people. Let's create a blame-free work environment and let's have a higher sense of responsibility both to our work and to our colleagues. Let me end this by quoting John Ruskin in 1851, and he said, "In order that people may be happy in their work, these three things are needed. They must be fit for it, they must not do too much of it, and they must have a sense of success in it." If you need more information about this article written by these two wonderful business managers, you could contact me for more information. My contact is on my profile page. I will be right back after this break. You're welcome back. On this segment, News on Breakout, there's really a very disturbing news that I got from Cameroon. And it says that child sexual abuse is growing in that country. Researchers from the Cameroonian branch of the international NGO, non-governmental organization, that's what I mean by that. And the name of that organization is The School as an Instrument of Peace or capital letters now, letter E, I, and P in French. This organization say that the figure of child sexual abuse show the scale of the problem nationwide. This report reinforces the finding of a study conducted by the local media between January and March. That survey showed many children are the victims of rape, incest, prostitution, sexual trafficking, and forced marriages. Some say these findings show that no child is currently safe in Cameroon. And I tell you, that's the most disturbing news I've had this week. Now, another news is Camp Rock to open today, Thursday, and the performance is to benefit CASA, and that is CASA, and we are talking about CASA of the Plains. Now, this is happening in Sterling, Loudoun County, Virginia. The Sterling Miracle Players, SMP, which is the acronym of their name. They are a non-profit organization that raise money through theater. They are gearing up for their latest production, the Disney Camp Rock, the musical. And this is set to hit the stage starting Thursday. This fall, SMP has chosen CASA of the Plains to benefit from the proceeds. And CASA, which stands for Court Appointed Special Advocate, is an organization that trains volunteers to work with abused and neglected children in the court system. CASA volunteers meet regularly with the child as well as family members, teachers, medical professionals, counselors, and others involved with the child's life. And I am afraid that's all I'll be able to take on news on Breakout. And I'll be ending the show with the last segment, Angels on a Mission. And I have this wonderful woman I'll be celebrating today. Her name is Grace Nemala. And this woman is standing up to a very disturbing culture in Andhra Pradesh, in Hyderabad. Now, this is in the country of India, and they have this cruel and medieval tradition of poor Dalit girls forcefully married off to the village deity and then sexually abused by the men in the village. So these Dalit girls are usually prepubescent girls, and they are called Joginis, which is Joginis, and they are selected by the village Sapanach. I hope I got that right, and that is spelled Sarpanch, and they are selected to become a village property for the sexual exploitation of men. Now, Grace heard about the Joginis in 1993 when she was a teacher in Hyderabad, and she quotes, "Many questions arose within me. I met many political people, priests, government officials, and they told me it was in their custom. They said that they were just worshipping the God, and they asked me why I was questioning and why I had a problem with that. I thereafter made a strong decision and started working with the women." And Grace has quit her job as a teacher and has moved to Mehbub Nagar district, which is notorious for pushing Dalit girls, and Dalit is D-A-L-I-T, into the Jogini system. She began a door-to-door campaign, but she was accused of corrupting the mind of the villagers and bringing the wrath of the deity on the village. she was asked to leave, but she refused to give up. She set up a home called Ashrav, which is AASHRAV, for the girls. Sorry, Ashray, AASHRAY, for the girls, and to the children that these girls eventually may have as a result of the sexual exploitation which they suffer. Grace now has awareness and rescue campaigns spread across 9 districts of Andhra Pradesh with a core team of 30 members. These committees are run by former joginis, and I tell you, this is a laudable step that Grace has taken. She has used the victims as weapons of victory, and I just don't know how best to say thank you to Grace for the wonderful work she's doing. Her organization has even conducted the first legal marriage for joginis in that area. Thank you, Grace. We love you, and we say keep up the good work. And guys, this is how far I'll be able to go with you on this edition of Breakout with BD. I hope you were able to learn a thing or two, and I hope you've been inspired and you've been fired up to make that needed change to improve the life of a child around you. We can't keep being silent and timid about making these changes. It's our responsibility to make the world a safer place for every child. I'll be with you next week, and until then, remember, the world is waiting for you to take that needed step. Take care and bye-bye.